The work of this church in the world is realized through the generous financial support of all who call this place home. Along with the gifts and time and talent, ours is a shared ministry. You have a role to play here. Church membership is open to all. For more information, go to uusf.org.
In the well-timed wake of the totality, and a day away from Earth Day 2024, we try to capture, or we start at least, in our examination of our relationship to Earth with a cosmic perspective. Neil deGrasse Tyson, the astrophysicist, TV personality, writer, and like Carl Sagan before him, a popularizer of both the world of stars and galaxies, but also how they move and inform us and our perspective on the world and ourselves. Tyson wrote a book that we read as part of the March Madness of the Ministers book group. As Tyson explains in the preface to the book, he titled his book after another that was published in 1610 by Galileo Galilei, titled Sidereus Nuncios, which translated means starry messengers. Galileo wrote his book after having perfected the telescope to begin to share some of what he'd seen and how it informed his sense of the universe and our place in it. It wasn't all he would come to know, but some very important beginnings. As any of us know who have heard the Indigo Girls song Galileo, this doesn't go well for the scientist. Galileo's head was on the block. The crime was looking up the truth. Charged by the Inquisition for dangerous heresy for his ideas, Galileo only survives by recanting some of what he knows, and for his silence, he receives the merciful sentence of a life under house arrest. What Galileo recants is the truth that the Earth is not actually the center of the universe, or our part of it, that the sun is, and somehow to 17th century papacy, the idea that God's blue-green marble with its humans made in God's image occupants not being at the center of the universe and everything else pivoting around them was a dangerous idea. It was, however, exactly what Galileo wanted us to see, that we couldn't, as Tyson points out, trust our own eyes to reveal the fundamental nature of the universe, and that Earth was not the center of all motion. These first ever cosmic perspectives in our world, writes Neil deGrasse Tyson, were ego checks on our own self-importance, messages from the stars, forcing people to rethink our relationship to one another, to Earth, and to the cosmos. We otherwise risk believing the world revolves around us and our opinions. And we do risk that. But Earth and a cosmic perspective on ourselves has this power to pull us back into right relationship with it all. We got a chance to do just that on December 24th, 1968. It was during the Apollo 8 mission, as that spacecraft rounded the dark side of the moon for the fourth time, when Earth broke the horizon and astronaut William Anders ran to get a camera and snap a shot, a photo. It wasn't the first image we had seen of Earth from space. Space probes and satellites had taken some, but they were blurry and not framed by the human eye. Earthrise, it came to be called. The distance from Earth, Tyson points out, was a mere 250 miles above the Earth's surface at sea level. If you held a school globe in your hands, 250 miles would just be a centimeter above the surface of the globe. Not much, but it gave us perspective. Very little of human civilization, Tyson writes, is recognizable, first of all, from orbit. You won't see the Great Wall. You'll barely make out the Great Pyramids of Egypt. Which is to say that much of what humans have made disappears from this height. As does, Tyson notes, pretty much everything else that divides all of us. National borders, politics, language, skin color, who you worship is invisible, he writes. A few things, it turns out, are visible, human-related things. From a distance, for instance, you can see green on one side of land and brown on another in one place with no mountain range to explain it. And elsewhere, there are lights that can be seen from space on one side of a divide that has darkness, relative darkness on the other. Both delineate national borders, it turns out, or territories. Gaza and Israel for the first, North and South Korea in the second case, multiples of GDP and access to resource separating them, but not any good earthly reason. It makes you think. William Anders's Earthrise photo was one of the most influential photos in history, certainly environmentally influential. It would capture a nation's imagination, that view, in more ways than one. Tyson wonders whether that animating image and the ones to follow were what propelled a nation, the United States, dancing around environmental issues and warnings into a decade of groundbreaking environmentally protective legislation that would follow. The first person to walk the moon comes a year later, in 1969. And in 1970, the first Earth Day, the Comprehensive Clean Air Act, the creation of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and the EPA, and in the 3 years to follow, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, and the first unleaded emission standards for gasoline and much else. Because what also struck people about those first photos and continues to is how beautiful Earth is. How lucky we are to be a part of that awe and wonder and gratitude filling us. In his memoir, Mike Massimino, who serviced the Hubble Space Telescope in his shuttle missions, wrote of his view of our planet, this view. He writes, "The thought went through my mind when I spacewalked and looked down on Earth that this must be the view from heaven. Then it was replaced by another thought. No, this must be what heaven looks like." And that realization, coupled with the realization of the absurdity and arbitrariness of our borders and manufactured separations, well, it moved us. Doctors Without Borders was also started in 1971, interestingly. As Edgar D. Mitchell, an Apollo 14 astronaut, said, quote, "You develop an instant global consciousness, a people orientation, an intense dissatisfaction with the state of the world and a compulsion to do something about it. From out there on Moon, international politics look so petty. You want to grab a politician by the scruff of the neck and drag them a quarter of a million miles back out and say, "Look at that!" This is what the telescope does, and space travel, at least for some, vicariously for many of us. Not so much that it told us about space, though it would, but it gives us this long view on ourselves. And that perspective was eye-opening and transformative in more ways than one. So we humans, we can get into right relationship and right perspective on Earth and our relationship to it and all of life through the telescope. But that's not the only way. What struck me is how paradoxically the reverse is also true. How we get in right relationship through the opposite of distance. From intimate, connected, close-up views of the world and ourselves in it. Like Richard on his bike. The way a bike does this for us more than a car, right? Connects you to these places as you go by. The swamp and the heat, I loved that description. And the sun and the breeze and the copperhead snakes. Is that what they were, copperhead snakes? And the smell of grasses and the trees and what's in bloom. The way Robin Wall Kimmerer, the professor of botany and member of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation, talks about the land that she knows and that her people claim as theirs, or better stated, that they are claimed by, which is so often the case. In her famous and gorgeous modern classic, Braiding Sweetgrass, how many people have read Braiding Sweetgrass or even parts of it? If you haven't read it, you have such a treat waiting for you. You can actually put it by your bedside and not stay awake all night. I have too many books on my bedside that I shouldn't read at my bedside, but this is one you could. It's just stunning. She talks about some of what that connection to land up close and intimate and attentive to it does for her and her understanding of her place in the world. Going out one day to harvest leeks, this is just one part of the book. It turns out she loves leeks, and it's a meal she's gonna prepare for her daughters who are coming home to visit, so they obviously love them too, so she heads out to harvest them, and she writes the following intimate connection moment. She writes, "On a day like this, when the fiddleheads are unfurling and the air is petal soft, I am awash with longing. I know that thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's chloroplast is good advice, and yet I must admit to full-blown chlorophyll envy. Sometimes I wish I could photosynthesize so that just by being, just by shimmering at the meadow's edge or floating lazily on a pond, I could be doing the work of the world while standing silent in the sun. The showy hemlocks and the waving grasses are spinning out sugar molecules and passing them on to angry mouths and mandibles, all the while listening to the warblers and watching the light dance on the water. It would be so satisfying to provide for the well-being of others, like being a mother again, like being needed. Shade, medicine, berries, roots. There would be no end to it. As a plant, I could make a campfire, hold the nest, heal the wound, fill the brimming pot. But this generosity is beyond my realm, as I am a mere heterotroph, a feeder on carbon transmuted by others. In order to live, I must consume, exchange a life for a life. Forced to choose, I must admit, I actually like my heterotroph role. Besides, if I could photosynthesize, I couldn't eat leeks. So instead, I live vicariously through the photosynthesis of others. I am not the vibrant leaves on the forest floor. I am the woman with the basket. It's this gorgeous, intimate, adoring walk with someone through her small patch of earth. And if seeing one another, really seeing one another, is a gift we give each other that brings us a little more fully into being, because I think it is, Kimmerer brings this place a little more fully into being, already vibrantly alive when she arrives, but ever so much a little bit more that way. And the moment doesn't end there for her in that intimacy and seeing and fullness of life being brought more alive. This patch of earth invites her into relationship, right? You can hear that in the passage, into a particular kind of reverie and relationship. She is the woman with the basket who realizes, she writes, that how I fill this basket matters. If we are fully awake, she goes on, a moral question arises as we extinguish the other lives around us on behalf of our own. Whether we are digging wild leeks or going to the mall, how do we consume in a way that does justice to the lives we take? In our oldest stories, she says, speaking of the stories her people repeated time after time, we are reminded that this was a question of profound concern for our ancestors. When we rely deeply on other lives, there is an urgency to protect them. Just like the astronauts seeing Earth and realizing it isn't just the view from heaven, but heaven itself. Or the global consciousness space awakens that wants us to shake petty politicians from their madness to pass protective legislation and erase borders. Kimmerer wonders aloud, the woman with the basket in the field shimmering green around her, amidst the makers of sugar and medicine and the very stuff of life as they dance in the wind, she wonders how this earth and her perspective on it informs her relationship transformatively, and how we do justice to the lives we are in relationship to. Our ancestors, who had so few material possessions, she writes, devoted a great deal of attention to this question, while we, who are drowning in possessions, scarcely give it a thought. Kimmerer's book, her work as a botanist, as a writer, like the memoirs of the astronauts and the photo that circulates of Earth rising, they call us to remember what we stand on every day, what we're anchored to try and jog our minds and hearts back to the most basic truth that sometimes we don't give a much of a thought to in the headlong tumble of our days and obligations, to see Earth and our rightful place with it. To get perspective, however we each do that best. To find and refine the urgency to protect, to heal, We are of the earth, as Joy Atkinson wrote in that reading we did together today. We breathe and live in the breath of ancient plants and beasts. You and I. We are held on this blue-green marble, spinning with water and forest and ocean and clay earth and swamp and snow-capped mountains. We're from a short distance, just a short distance above the surface. All that we think divides us is erased. Religion, culture, geography, history, almost impossible to see. And what remains is evidence of our interdependence and how lucky we are to be alive. May we hold and keep hold of that feeling of awe wherever we connect to it, and with it, the urgency to protect, particularly now, a time to reflect on it. May we see with the eyes of astronauts and the woman with her basket lost in a field of green, harvester of leeks, or whatever way we do so, to right our relationship and perspective. And in so doing, all days be earth days and all life be richly, eternally blessed until we vanish back into the stardust from which we came. So may it be.
Earth Day program. How I remember George Welch Elementary School, Earth Day program. It was my first Earth Day, the first Earth Day, and I remember I didn't quite get why all the buzz about a day to celebrate what I took for granted. Riding my bike in the swamps near our school, I took that wilderness for granted. It welcomed me with adventure, and I loved it. Except when I saw dead copperheads on the trail. Children can be so blind to real danger. But those road closed and keep out signs didn't keep me from enjoying the sun on my back, pretending my bike's tires could get me through anything, and the feeling of freedom in the air. I remember my fifth grade teacher droning over and over again, "You are on the verge of becoming young adults." What does that mean? I thought. Now I know. Code for puberty. On the verge of something between marbles and underarm deodorant. A science fiction nerd, I liked Earth Day's connection with planets and our place in the solar system. Peering through the green moon filter on my telescope, looking for Kubrick's monolith, everything seemed so peaceful and serene. The first Earth Day was celebrated in April 1970, and I was there. That meant Dover Air Force Base, roaring jet engines, never occurring to me that their roar was anything other than a lullaby. Earth Day meant first kisses and changing bodies. My first kiss, another boy with a big smile and chapped lips, and perfectly turned out school projects. Mine, not so much. We were competitors and friends at the same time. I loved my science teacher's model of the solar system, the planets moving when you cranked it. There was a connection between us, a knowing twinkle in his eye. I think he saw me for who I could become. A budding entrepreneur, maybe. I tried it on, taking our lawnmower and bags around to neighbors who would pay for a trim. Naively, never giving a second thought to who would buy the gas or pay for repairs, I was rolling in dime store cash for a minute. Those were the years of changes, full of signs and hints that for sure something was coming. We could have never loved the earth so well if we had had no childhood in it. George Eliot from The Mill on the Floss. I experienced my first Earth Day through the eyes of a child, and I knew it was special. Our school held a massive die-in at our neighboring sewage treatment plant. So much fun to walk up to the plant, its lawn green and wide, well-fertilized, and then die in, dramatically, of course. We didn't realize the point that we had a hand in protecting our most valuable possessions ourselves. Our Earth Day song, something dreamed up and sung earnestly and dramatically to the tune of 2001, A Space Odyssey. It was a time of moon landings broadcast in black and white, summer ceramic and judo classes I hated, of singing out loud in Sunday school, "Do you love Jesus? Yes, I love Jesus." When today the sun is warm on my face and neck, I'm reminded of that time, that innocence, that Earth Day, the days we celebrated being on the cusp of becoming young adults, those days of confusion and clarity and change. I knew something was coming, and I knew that the Earth was my home. What kept me going were those teachers, those educators, even if just for a day. They organized that Earth Day. In their lessons, our young minds, and in our young minds, wisdom was sown. Those seeds would sprout in me, leaving me with a sense that there are things in this world that are larger than me, but nothing is more important than playing my small part in all of this creation. Those lessons remind me that though my body may change over time, I will never lose that connection.